I'm very happy to participate in the celebration of Stanley's 80th birthday. My years at Berkeley were 1968 through 71, and I'm going to celebrate Stanley by using something that he did for string theory to perhaps lend some insight into larger engaged theory. So what I'm after here is the idea that string theory, this is largely motivated and stimulated by the ADS-CFT correspondence, string theory can tell us something about gauge theory. And I'm not so interested in supersymmetric gauge theories, I'm interested in QCD. I would like to see what string theory can tell us about QCD. So I'm going to go back to an early time, not as early as the 60s, but back to 1971 with Sherrick and Navarin Sherrick's observation that if you take the open string theory, any open string theory with SUN Chan Peyton factors and take the low energy limit, which is summarized by saying that alpha prime goes to zero, you get Yang-Mills theory for the same group, the same gauge group SUN. So from that point on, we knew that string theory had something to do with gauge theory. It was a limit. Gauge theory seemed to be a limit of string theory. What I'm going to do today is basically suggest that what we should regard, how we should regard this relationship is that the left-hand side is a regulated version of the right-hand side. So unlike the ADS-CFT correspondence, where you really try to take alpha prime to zero and get a duality between two low energy theories, I'm suggesting that keep alpha prime finite and see what you can get. From the very early days, we knew that once we had open strings, we would have closed strings as well. That came from the studies of loop amplitude. Now, David mentioned that these mathematical models live in higher dimensions. Joe Polchinski's idea of getting a four-dimensional quantum field theory out of a 10-dimensional theory was the idea of D3 brains. And that's going to be, that's certainly important in the ADS-CFT correspondence. A D3 brain, I don't have to explain this to this audience probably, but a D3 brain is a place in space-time, four-dimensional space-time, where open strings are open. So by fixing the ends of the open string to a four-dimensional subspace of some higher dimensional space, here I'm thinking of 10 dimensions, the 10-dimensional superstring, for example, one gets a four-dimensional theory because one breaks the translational invariance in the other six dimensions. And one only has four momenta that are available. And the way this works is if you have an open string coordinate, xm of sigma and tau, m being the index, then you put Neumann conditions, free n conditions on the first four components, and Dirichlet conditions on the last six components. So that's the central idea in getting a four-dimensional quantum field theory out of one of these string theory. Okay, now, if I'm going to work at finite alpha prime, and I want to borrow or be stimulated or be inspired by the ADS-CFT correspondence, I need to have a stringy version of the ADS-CFT duality, and this is what I suggest. It's a fact in string theory that if you sum over all the planar open string loop diagrams, let's say open strings with ends on this D3 brain, or stack of D3 brains, then you have an alternative interpretation of that sum of planar diagrams as a sum of closed string trees in a D3 brain background. So this is something that is simply true about string theory, that open string loops can be thought of, an open string loop can be thought of as a closed string disappearing into the vacuum. And that's like a background. And if you work in the large n limit, so it's planar open string loops, then you're working in the classical approximation in the closed string theory, closed string trees. Now, In the ABS-CFT correspondence, you take this relation and take alpha prime to zero and then try to formulate a precise relationship between the gauge theory on the open string side and some and a gravity theory on the closed string side. But there is a hitch because there's a condition on the Tupft coupling constant. It has to be large in order for in order to replace this classical closed string field theory by classical gravity. If the coupling is not large, the closed string field theory has to be treated as a closed string field theory. Since in QCD we want to work with finite coupling or zero coupling because of asymptotic freedom, the theme of this talk is why not try planar graph summation with alpha prime bigger than zero? I mean, that feeds in all of the information about the ADS-CFT duality, but at the at an earlier level when alpha prime is still non-zero. Okay, and this comes to using a tool that was developed by Stanley. So basically I want to describe the problem of summing planar diagrams as taking place, summing planar diagrams as taking place on the light cone world sheet that Stanley introduced. What one gets essentially is because the world sheet is a two-dimensional theory, is some kind of a two-dimensional dynamical system that represents the sum of planar diagrams. Whether or not one can actually solve that analytically, one might be able to actually get numerical information by studying that, that two-dimensional system on a computer. It's not quite the same thing as lattice gauge theory, which was is studying a four-dimensional lattice gauge theory on a computer. It's a smaller dimensional lattice, so it might be in some ways you can get closer to the continuum, but of course a finer lattice. Okay, so here is a typical planar interacting string diagram, as Mandelstam introduced, for open strings. So each of these horizontal slits is represents a string that has broken into two. So at this point, at this time, we have a single string. At this point, it breaks, and you have two strings, and then this string joins onto a string that was already there, and so on. And by summing over all locations and all sizes of those slits, one is summing over all the planar diagrams, all of the open string planar diagrams of the theory. Okay, I guess we've had so many light cone talks so far, I don't really have to go into the definition of X plus and P plus. Now, if this string theory is a critical string theory, then the action, so you're doing a path integral over those domains, and the action is simply that of a free open string. The interactions, the interactions are introduced by strings joining and separating, but those are taken care of by doing the sum over all the locations and sizes of those slits. So the action never departs from this free form, and all of the interactions are encoded in all of those different boundaries. Okay. Now, in order to realize such a thing, well, no, let me make a pause. So here is a moment. I want to say something that I think is actually quite important. These path histories are ordinary quantum mechanical path histories in the light cone. So their normalization is fixed by unitarity. That's not something that is, you can't just throw in arbitrary constant. If you look at the most basic three-string interaction, two strings joining to a third string, and you normalize the states according to the S matrix, the standard S matrix or probability amplitude, then Lorentz covariance demands, you see that the shape of this domain depends on the kinematics, P plus 1, P plus 2, of the particle. Lorentz covariance says that the vertex should be proportional to 1 over the square root of the product of all of those P pluses. These are just the familiar 1 over square roots of E's in S matrix elements computed from the Lagrangian field theory. So, and this could be multiplied by some function of the ratios of the p pluses and the ratios of the time over the p pluses. But there's this overall factor here, which means that if you scale p plus, all the p pluses by the same scale, and scale the whole diagram by the same amount, this predefined, remember this is a normalized thing according to standard probability, that thing should scale like lambda to the minus 3 halves power. In a paper that Giles and I wrote back in 1977, we did this path integral literally by doing a by putting it on a lattice and doing and calculating the Gaussian integrals and learned that the scaling law was not lambda to the minus 3 halves, but rather lambda to the minus d minus 2 over 16. And of course, if you see, if you compare, in order for it to be 3 halves, d has to be 26. So from this point of view, the critical dimension comes from this very simple process. The scaling law here has to match, and therefore you get the critical dimension. In the superstring, you basically have half the number of degrees of freedom. Counting a fermion as a half, you have 12 degrees of freedom instead of 24 degrees of freedom. And so this factor comes out wrong from the overlap, but it's corrected by putting what Nathan was talking about, the interaction point operator in there. That corrects the scaling law to, again, lambda to the minus 3 halves in 10 dimensions for the superstring. Okay, now a little bit of entertainment before I show the next page. When Stanley did his calculations of the beta function, I mean, one of the triumphs of his formalism was that he was actually able to calculate the beta function from the graph, which has one more line, say, from here to here, and show that it was the beta function. There was the question of the measure. And he didn't do a grid. He had an argument that the measure had to be a certain form. Basically, what Nathan was saying, the measure factor had to cancel the Jacobian to the of a map to the upper half plane. Later on, he realized that there was a formula by McKean and Singer that actually allowed him to calculate the shape dependence of the determinant. And I thought, well, I should also be able to understand this scaling law also from the McKean and Singer formula. When I applied it, it didn't work. So, and I thought, well, there's just something wrong. I mean, either something wrong with what I was doing or something wrong with McKean and Singer. But of course, that's not true. Neither, but we're both right. There's an earlier paper to McKean and Singer by Mark Katz. It's entitled "Hearing the Sound," hearing the shape. I don't know if it's sound, hearing the shape of a drum. And he actually, I just when I came here, I downloaded it and read it and spent a good deal of time just understanding it. It's actually a very beautiful paper. But it only does a polygonal drum, straight lines. And the formula isn't the McKean-Singer formula, which is only true for smooth boundaries. It's this formula. There's an area contribution, so you're getting the distribution of the eigenvalues of the Laplacian here. There's an area contribution, a perimeter contribution, and then for each corner of the polygon, that expression there, where theta is the opening angle of the polygon. The light cone vertex is a 360-degree corner, right? It's two edges that are right on top of each other. So that's 2 pi in this formula. That's the minus 1 over 16. We have d minus 2 of these oscillators. So this is, in fact, the same calculation that Giles and I did, but it was done 10 years earlier in a different context. This is a case where rounding the corner would spoil something very, very nice. The corner is actually important in the light cone string formalism. That's my message. Okay, suppose we actually wanted to sum planar diagrams. Then as always, when you try to actually do a path integral, you do it on a grid. You don't try to do a continuum path integral unless you know the answer because it's a Gaussian. You set it up on a grid. That's what the lattice gauge theory people do. That's what we should do. So you set it up on a grid. The slits that I have drawn on the previous diagram are just places on the grid where the sigma is going this way and tau is going horizontally, places where the vertical links are missing links. And you just sum over all possible arrangements of missing links on the lattice. That's the prescription for summing over planar diagrams in the simplest bosonic string theory. In the fermionic theory, the presence of the extra operator, interaction point operators, complicates this, and maybe the supersheet is the way to go. I have to talk to Nathan about that. But if you want to represent sort of in a single line what the effective measure is for that sum, you start out with, so you're just basically taking dx dt squared as the difference of two x's in the time direction squared. Dx d sigma squared is the difference of two in the sigma direction squared. And when it's missing or not, you have a spin variable that is either one or zero. So summing over all possible missing link arrangements is the same as summing over all possible spin configurations on this lattice. And then the coupling constant comes in this way because the coupling constant comes in at the beginning when there is a spin flip from 1 to 0 or from 0 to 1. And the formula that I wrote there is basically designed to give a factor of g for every beginning and end of a slit. So that's the statistical system you're summing here. It doesn't look so devastating. It's an Ising coupled to a quadratic scalar field. Of course, it will be more complicated in the superstring case, and I'm just trying to sketch ideas here. Now, there's another way of thinking about the sum of planar diagrams that Martin Kruzinski, another Argentinian physicist, who is now, I think, at Purdue, suggests thinking about the sum this way, which brings us back also to an earlier time in string theory. That is, at least for generic arrangement of slits, you can divide it, if you go to the cross channel, so to speak, use duality, identify the initial and final state, so you're taking a trace and doing a partition function, then at least generically speaking, you only have one slit at a time if you view it in this cross channel. So this is like a geometrical series. It's like the standard self-energy series that you make when you put the self-energy into the denominator of a propagator. And all it does is add a term to the closed string Hamiltonian. So that would be an operator way. You don't really have to introduce a lattice for this. Define the matrix element of that operator and try to diagonalize it, or try to diagonalize that plus the free closed string Hamiltonian. That's another approach. Okay, when did I start, Nathan? Well, I mean, that's basically the proposal, though. So the idea is that maybe to exploit string theory in field theory, maybe the thing to do is regulate the field theory by a finite alpha prime and then execute the sum on a world sheet lattice, the light cone. Now, how you do that will depend upon the theory. So in the classic ADS-CFT case, the relevant open string is the NSR GSO projected open string, which is required to end on D3 brain. I'll just skip the rest of that slide because it's such a familiar story. What would we do for Yang-Mills? So the name of the game is to find an open string theory that we can put on one of these world sheet lattices. We don't want fermions in Yang-Mills and non-supersymmetric Yang-Mills, so just delete the Ramon sector. That gives you... Pierre's not very happy. they'll come back. RR will come back and duplicate. that gets rid of the fermions, The bosonic string is an idea, but actually the Neuber-Schwarz string projected onto the even G parity sector is a better idea because it doesn't have a tachyon in the open string theory. The fact that we have thrown out the R sector means that there will be a tachyon in the closed string theory, but that might actually be a positive thing rather than a negative thing. The simplest thing to do would just be what Neuber and Schirk did back in 1971, because they didn't know about 10 dimensions at that point. They were dealing with a four-dimensional model. If you take a four-dimensional model, it's subcritical, but if you take its low energy limit, it is precisely Yang-Mills. However, that introduces complications, which I don't want to go into right now, associated with a conformal anomaly, and it would be very nice if we could keep the theory 10-dimensional, critical, so the conformal anomaly cancels. The trouble with that is that if you now apply the D3 brain trick to get to four-dimensional theory, then you've got basically the six extra polarizations of the gluon become massless scalars. So instead of having Yang-Mills theory, you have Yang-Mills theory coupled to six massless scalars. It's not quite the theory you want. Okay, so now in just a couple of minutes, I just want to sketch an idea for getting rid of those massless scalars. It's based on what I said about the four-dimensional theory. The four-dimensional theory did not have massless scalars. Its low energy limit was precisely Yang-Mills. And in order to see why that happened and we didn't have a massless scalar, compare, so this is just the partition function that counts the number of states in the Neuber-Schwarz model for the open string in nine dimensions. Compare that to what you would get with Joe's D3 brains. This factor here, 1 minus W to the 1/2, is absent. What's happening here is that the gauge conditions are eliminating only one degree of freedom per oscillator mode in the nine-dimensional open string, so that the physical degrees of freedom sort of match the 10-dimensional theory. But the massless vector in the open string theory is a gauge particle, and it has an extra state removed. It's a transverse gauge particle. So you have an incomplete partition function. So if we could make the D3 brain construction match that formula, we would be in business, because we would, the fact that this extra 1 minus W to the 1/2 is there is a reflection of the fact that there's no extra massless scaling. Okay, and I think maybe I'll just do two more slides and then I'll stop. Okay, so the goal here is to see if I can modify the D3 brain boundary condition so that it maps onto the open string theory in nine dimensions rather than the open string on a D3 brain in 10 dimensions. I'm going to start by taking the D3 brain conditions, the normal ones, x9 equal to 0, and doing a T-dual transform to a coordinate that satisfies Neumann conditions, and then the fact that the x-coordinate had Dirichlet conditions means that the momentum in the ninth direction is 0. So it's like you think of it as an open string with free ends, except you don't allow it to have any momentum in that direction. That's equivalent to an open string required to end on D3 brains. Then, if I just think about that C equals 1 theory, which is represented by the Y9 coordinate that I've just introduced, I can think of it equally well as a field that is compactified on a circle, so that its momenta are discrete, and then I just require that n be 0, that discrete momentum just be 0. It has the same effect. There is an SU2 symmetry for a certain value of r, where the tachyon with a certain value of momentum is exactly massless, just like the vector particle. In that SU2 symmetry, those three states transform as a vector. So if I generalize the n equals 0 condition to requiring SU2 invariants, and this SU2 invariant, then I knock out that massless scalar. Now, that just gets me to a nine-dimensional theory. But now I can repeat for x8, x7, x6, x5, and x4, and I get a four-dimensional theory. Okay, there's one kind of, there's a well-known construction of the SU2 generators here, but the essential point is I'm not allowed to just make any projections whatsoever. It's very important that the physical state conditions commute with the SU2 symmetry condition that I'm making. This vertex operator construction establishes that that is true. There's an invariant, O3 invariant description, which I'll skip. I'll skip scattering amplitudes. Basically, the trees are a subset of the 10-dimensional amplitudes, but when I construct loops, I have to make sure that the states that I have projected out don't reappear with a projection operator. And that can be handled basically by a group theory projection operator using the Haar measure. And what it amounts to is basically gauging those that extra O3 or SU2. So since I'm out of time, I'm not going to discuss those issues. And so there's the summary of my talk. So I'm suggesting that we should use string theory for gauge theory by, first of all, taking alpha prime finite as a regulator of the gauge theory and then study that theory seriously. In the large n limit, I've indicated or shown how the actual sum over planar diagrams looks very much like a two, well, looks exactly like a two-dimensional system in which the coordinates, which are represented by scalar fields on the world sheet, are coupled to an Ising spin system. And the coupling constant dependence gives you a kinetic term for the Ising spin system. That was that complicated formula. And I've suggested one possible open string to take for the four-dimensional Mills theory, but there are lots. I mean, basically, all you have to do is make sure that the massless scalars are absent, and there are several different ways of doing that. This is just one. So that's the end of my talk, and I close by wishing Stanley a happy birthday. Gets factorially worse, right? Because the planar diagrams, you just basically have a spin system, and you have to, because the non-planar diagrams involve strings, you know, if you have n strings, then they can reattach in n factorial different ways. That I think that would be a numerical disaster, probably. Well, I think this. Well, you have to. You would have to resolve the closed string tachyon before you took alpha prime to zero, because I mean that's for sure. Because the closed string tachyon represents an instability, which, you know, I don't think is necessarily bad. I mean, you've taken an approximation and found a tachyonic state. That's like a Cooper pair. The precursor to BCS theory was Cooper's bound state of two electrons on the Fermi surface. That was basically a tachyonic state, and then the resolution is important. So that has to be done. But alpha prime, remember, is just, I mean, the scale of excitations is 1 over alpha prime. So the string, I mean, that's actually part of the ADS law, too. Taking alpha prime to 0 removes all the excited states of the open string. So that's why you say it's a gauge theory, as alpha prime goes to 0. So I'm just saying that it might be a good idea to keep alpha prime finite a little longer, not try to take it to zero right away, because you don't have the conformal invariance of n equals 4 working for you.